This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 189. I can't believe it's not Topoline. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the recent Beverly Crusher Day and the upcoming Deanna Troi Day, more from the Star Trek Beyond Dubai set, and we discussed the StarTrek.com poll that asked which series has the saddest episodes. Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt and Zachary Frühling to discuss the original series episode, Friday's Child. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Larry. Welcome back to The Ready Room. It's great to have you here with me once again, and this week to talk about some original series. And in fact, we're going to talk about what you consider to be the most underappreciated episode of TOS, I believe, later on.
Yeah, Chris, thanks for having me back. Original series is always nearest and dearest to your heart, and to my heart anyway. And yeah, I didn't come up with that title. I just kind of had it foisted upon me by the outside world. It occurred to me thanks to the outside world. So one day I woke up and realized that was my stand on it. So I can't wait for us to get into Friday's Child, and maybe not champing it to be all things wonderful and keen about Star Trek, but just to have people take a second look. I didn't even realize people weren't taking a second or third or fourth or even 19th look at it, but I'll get out and champion. It's a great McCoy show, and I can't wait to get into it.
Yeah, so Zachary and Char are going to join us for that, and we'll find out why everyone should love Friday's Child. But before that, we want to talk about something from not the original series, but the Next Generation. One thing that just recently passed was Beverly Crusher Day, and that inspired another lady from the Next Generation, Marina Sirtis, to have a Deanna Troi Day, which is coming up, I understand.
Yeah, and I just want to throw this out as a shout out, and I should make it clear here. It's a little bit the way Tom Paris Day and Captain Picard Day, which was actually a canon event, but people in social media, especially Twitter, and they hashtag these things. It's not the actors doing this, it's fans,
right,
and something
right.
else fun to do. But it's always a character where we actually know their canon birthday, or maybe somebody that's next door canon. Everybody talks about headcanon. I'm always talking about next door canon. Has come up with a day for that. And it just happened that as a support to Gates McFadden's new project called Gates Plays, which is she's trying to have a whole new paradigm storytelling project, plays and other things. And totally out of her own inner circle, fans came up with the idea for Beverly Crusher Day, hashtag, because like all the Next Gen people, thanks to the episode Conundrum, when they get their memories back or in the process of getting memories back, it's a very obvious screen read, and it's even more so in the remasters. All of the basic biofile sheets came up that Mike Okuda and the art staff put together, and part of the biofile is very specific birth dates and parents and birthplaces and all that cool, you know, tech head, canonista type stuff. So we've got birthdays for all the original, Next Generation people. And on Beverly Crusher Day that just passed, people were having fun with that. And also leading into GatesPlays.com, I believe. So as a spinoff of that, it just so happened that to help Marina out, they're having a Deanna Troi Day hashtag on October 28th, she's got an Indiegogo going for an actual network-level sitcom pilot called Eternity, which the log line for it was, or the tagline was, it's kind of funny. It says, Eternity is what you get if Scrubs met ER and they went to Comic-Con together.
Right. Yeah, I read that and I was trying to imagine what that would be. Does that conjure up an image in your head, Larry?
I ruined it and I read about it. But I mean, yeah, it's a half-hour sitcom dramedy, but it's got a storytelling element of one of those things where they flash over, which I think is the Scrubs element. You know, they flash out to somebody's thought bubble. It's like what they do on Family Guy and that kind of thing too. You know, they go out of the moment to a goofy, just those zany, wacky little fleets of mental thought that come back.
Yeah.
And anyway, Marina's one of the leads.
How I Met Your Mother a little bit too.
Yeah, right? It's a staple now of a lot of things. But this is from a medical situation, but with actually some pathos mixed in with the comedy. And there's a character that's a big fanboy. And a lot of the character references, one of those little flash out moments are genre, you know, comic and sci-fi fan related. So anyway, it looks like a lot of fun. And I think Michael Dorn has a brief cameo, but he's going to direct this pilot if they can get it done. So anyway, Deanna Troi Day, October 28th, hashtag it. And people are trying to point to their Indiegogo campaign. Maybe we can put the link up. Instead of trying to rattle this off, but they do have a Eternity TV show is the Twitter handle.
Excellent, yeah. And looking at their Indiegogo, they're actually doing Indiegogo has two types of funding. They have flex funding and fixed funding, and the fixed funding is more like Kickstarter, where you set an exact amount and you have to reach that. And for Eternity, they've actually chosen fixed funding of $100,000, and so they do need to reach that goal in order to get any of the money. They have 26 days to go. They're at 13,436 as we record this from 169 people. And their goal is 100,000. So if you're interested in seeing Marina in this show and helping her get this made, then head on over there. And we'll put a link in the show notes. But if you just go to Indiegogo.com and look up Eternity, Eternity, then it should come right on up in the search. And they have a video there as well.
Right.
It's showing a little bit of what they have in mind. So
obviously it's a cross there between intern and eternity.
Yep.
So, hashtag Deanna Troi Day is October 28th. So pass it on.
Awesome. All right. So let's move on to the next thing we want to talk about. This is another poll from StarTrek.com, which I like to cover here on the Ready Room from time to time. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on the results, but also which episodes might be of interest here. The poll asked which series had the saddest episode. Now, that's a really hard thing, and it's very subjective as well. More than 9,000 fans voted, and of course they were given the option of all of the live action series plus the animated series. So all six Star Trek series are in here. The results, I'll give you quickly a rundown. Coming in last, not surprisingly, with 1% of the vote was the animated series, 9% Enterprise, 11% Voyager, 14% the original series, 29% Deep Space Nine, 36% The Next Generation. And I think, as you said on the other side of the room, Larry, TNG won probably just because they have the numbers. They have the largest number of fans of all the series.
Just demographics. Well, see, but it always throws me when the animated series gets pulled out by itself. Now, in this case, I think a lot of times the animated series, partly for its animation, partly because there's only 24 half-hour episodes, may get overlooked by people or people forget to include it. But in my, you know, in my head canon or my head processing, I always include movie. Anything with a crew era, I always throw in together. So the movies go with their respective two series, and the animated, to me, goes into original series. But I can see why they might do this. And they've got the clip here from yesteryear with Ichaya, Spock's Sellet.
The only animated series episode that anyone knows, unless you really take the time to watch the animated series.
What?
And study
it. No infinite Vulcan? No 60-foot-tall Spock? Come on, people.
So the results are interesting to me here because especially between Voyager and the original series, I think Voyager has more sad moments than the original series has. You know, I think of episodes like Tuvix, which can be sad, and certainly Death Wish, which I think has some really sad moments to it. And the one that I always think of from Voyager is Real Life, where the Doctor has his holographic family, because the scene at the end when his daughter is dying is one of the most moving scenes in Star Trek in general for me. You know, if I pick out from all of Star Trek and I just make a list of the most heart-wrenching moments to watch, you know, that's probably in my top 10 to 15, maybe. It's there. You know, it's up there with me with things like Spock dying, actually, in The Wrath of Khan, even in terms of how it moves me.
Well, and there's a meta element to that one, to Real Life, because the Doctor's choosing to do that.
Yeah.
It's not just any character watching their daughter die. It's the Doctor choosing to have himself experience that. There's almost, it's almost like a force feedback loop or something there. It reinforces itself. But this poll, hearing about it and all that, I mean, it may sound semantics or whatever, but you can define sad different ways. I mean, and I'm not even talking about, you know, being from the South. Now, have you ever seen that episode, And the Children Shall Lead? Now, that's just sad. Now, I don't even, I don't mean that definition, but I mean that, you know, sad can be grim. It could be devastating. It can be poignant, you know? I mean, I think of, we're jumping around here, but like the original series, I think of or Dark. Like, I think of A Private Little War. I know we're going to talk about Friday's Child in a little bit here, but Private Little War, when I was old enough to realize how darkly that ends, and we kid about the my term is the Flintstones endings, but, you know, the happy endings of shows when they're, you know, like the end of Tribbles and the McCoy endings of shows and things, but Private Little War ends up where they do not solve the problem, and it's very grim. So this spectrum of meaning for sad, I think they're going for the tearjerkers. But
I think so.
Are some things that are powerfully moving and poignant, and anyway, in a dark way. But yeah,
if you think about The Next Generation, because of course you wrote the TNG companion, sad moments in The Next Generation. What comes to mind for you?
Well, that's a big swath, and I think Inner Light's in there. But
yeah,
maybe this is an easy one. But another one that comes to mind is Dark Page. Mm-hmm. Deanna and her little sister, because it was late in the season, in the series, and didn't really see it coming. I mean, by the time the show was over, you did, but I mean, as an episode choice. The shows that ran a full 7 years did have a... I'm with you, though. I think some of the episodes on Voyager are getting... Tuvix was one of mine, too. I'm thinking Voyager's... The original series is kind of interesting, because I don't think... I think it was a little bit more in that everything has to end happy, and if not happy, it ends vague. So I don't think we had too many tragedies. Well, of course, Sit on the Edge of Forever and Edith.
Yeah, that's kind of the one that comes up for me, and I can't think of as many more for the original series, although you said that you group them by crews, in which case when we get into the films, then of course we have The Wrath of Khan.
Right.
And we have other moments in the films that work, even if you go out to Generations when Kirk dies. Deep Space Nine, for me, has probably the most what I would define as sad moments. And, of course, they're scattered. It's not necessarily that the entire episode is sad, although The Visitor is very difficult for me to watch these days, of course, having lost my father. But it was always very tough to watch, you know, even... It's a great episode, but it's emotionally tough to watch. And for me, things like even an Emissary, when the prophets are talking to Sisko about Jennifer and you see Sisko struggling with the loss of his wife. Fortunately, I don't have that experience, but I do have the experience of having lost loved ones. And therefore, that's very like a tear-jerking for me as well.
Well, I'm just looking here at the list of episodes, but Duet is one where it's a guest star that you just lost, but the power of that show is, it's really just, it is a duet. It's Kira and... and the Cardassian's name escapes me at the moment, but the guy who you find out wasn't even the war criminal, but he felt so guilty for his people that he pretended to be the war criminal. And that packed a real wallop just in that 1 hour. And then you get into the war years. I mean, there are a lot of them that are really, like I said, they're really poignant and tragic. To Kenny Gaymore, her father, her Cardassian would-be father that Kira wound up feeling close to. I mean, the whole Cardassian-Bajoran dynamic just had so much tragedy wrapped up in it that it was easy to do that. Having Kira go back and see her father again and revisit, you know, it seemed like that was... It seems like tragedy and sadness. I guess the theme here that's merging is Kira's a lot of that, aside from the ones that you talk about. But also, like the siege of AR-558 and Nog and his leg. Even though there's a piece of me that goes, oh, come on, it's just a leg, and they've got advanced medicine, and he can, you know, have a replacement, not even like we think of as a prosthetic, but even better than that.
But the nice part of how they handled that on DS9 is that they didn't make it super easy. You know, he didn't just go into sick bay and get the leg fixed, and then he's back to normal, right?
Whip up another one, right.
While we're on DS9, you know, going back to your Southern thing there, I'd just like to say, you know, that episode, Prophet and Lace, that's just sad.
That's just sad.
with Enterprise, there are some good ones as well. Similitude, of course, comes to mind.
Oh, that's, Twilight is, even though it's a reset button show, Twilight has its moments.
Sad for me as well.
Oh, we said similitude, but another one that comes up is The Forgotten, which is about Tripp's guilt that he feels that he lost an engineer that he barely knew, and the whole episode is reading her logs and going back. Anyway, that's a real heartstring puller as well. And of course, Enterprise is a little bit like DS9 in a bottle, because DS9 had the war stories that kind of almost set themselves up for that. Nor the Battle to the Strong is another one that's got its moments on DS9. And it seemed like the Zindir was really packed for that. Of course, losing their, even though it was a manufactured clone baby, but Tripp and T'Pol losing their child at the end of the Terra Prime is another moment too. Again, sometimes we have more major moments scattered through some of these than we do standout shows.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, more than the entire episode being sad, they're just sad moments scattered throughout. So, but anyway, I thought it was interesting to see the results and just to see what episodes come to mind for you and for me. And I'm curious, for anyone listening, go to the Babel Conference on Facebook, type BABEL into the search field, and you'll get there. And that's a great place to discuss this further and tell us which episodes you find the saddest. And why you find them sad, because like Larry said, it's very subjective. You know, you may find it sad for a very different reason than someone else. All right, well, let's talk about one more thing, Larry, before we wrap up news here and head into the feature. And this is what I'm calling Operation Dubiolate. As soon as I saw the photos from Star Trek Beyond Dubai set, I thought that looks a lot like Denova in Operation Annihilate in the original series, and could they possibly be picking up a story element from there? Did you see that at all, or do you have another take on the images that are coming out from Dubai?
Yeah, because I looked around. You look in the background there, and you can swear that they're building Gemini space capsules. No, I'm kidding. It was Northrop Grumman where they designed the Gemini and also the lunar module in the 60s. Space City, here we come. No, you know what? I looked at those and I saw that and I went, okay, well, fine. They're going to do that. Oh, how nice. They found a real world place where they didn't have to, you know, matte painting everything in, or they can extend it or whatever. What my takeaway from those was some of the, and I think something I was looking at pointed it out, but the alien heads, it really threw me back into all the alien heads from the motion picture, from the wreck deck scene and the tram scene. You know, the Starfleet scene. It's like somebody sat down and said, we're going to have a ton of aliens and spend a lot of money on them. And even what's amazing here is like Bob Fletcher, the costume designer, not Fred Phillips and the makeup people, but the costume people came up with the costumes and invented, you know, sometimes they were just really obvious heads and sometimes they were organic makeups that had prosthetics. But I think part of the thing there is not to spend a lot of time and to have it be a pullover head. And thinking they're all going to be, some of them are not going to look great in close up, but if they're in a mob, there's something. But the fact that somebody took the time to come up with like cultural backgrounds for the Amazerites, you know, and and the Khazarites and some of that stuff. But the fact that they're totally irrelevant. They looked good. I'm shocked that somebody took the time to write two paragraphs about each one. But that's it. They're like dead-end species that weren't organic to the story. They weren't a part of the story. And so they almost never get picked up anywhere again, ever used again. We did get all those planets. Jeff did, and then I picked them up again in like star maps. So they do live there. But anyway,
so
I saw those.
You're seeing that in the
saw the Dubai
well.
Photos, right. And I thought the same thing. I thought, well, these are all – in fact, these all even look – these large heads, I thought, I wonder if those are getting named. I wonder if they're bothering to give them, you know, background sketches, or if we're just going to go, oh, look, aliens.
Well, the thing, Larry, going back to the motion picture and even this, these characters would not be irrelevant if Star Trek could market itself the way Star Wars does, because think of all the action figures that we had back in the 70s and the 80s that they appeared in the movie somewhere in the background. Never mentioned by name, never spoke a word, but they had a name and they had a story and they had an action figure.
Right. And now we're mourning all that because it went away because they were so relevant. I know a lot of people were not happy with Trek doing that, but I think it was the saner path to take. And now that Star Wars has turned to the dark side and left the expanded universe behind, it was just saner never to have gone down that road. Of course, Star Trek had – part of that was Star Wars trying to flesh out the fact, make up for the fact that they only had, you know, 6 2-hour movies and then a couple of seasons of an animation barely versus 737 hours of Star Trek Live. But still, the fact remains. So, no, that was my takeaway was I wonder if we're going to actually, if these are totally here for just, you know, literal set dressing and eye candy and, ooh, look, they're so alien-y. Or if there's something actually going on with them. I tend to think, you know, like if there was just a sale at a Dubai Halloween costume shop and these are just off the shelf, or if they actually designed them or what. So we'll see. We'll see.
That would be funny. Yeah, I'm curious to see what they're doing with the sets in Dubai as well. But at least they're, you know, shooting stuff outdoors like that. And I think it's going to be cool. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be fun to speculate on what it all means.
Yeah. I mean, we're making fun here, but I really, truly am curious to see. I think the expectations are so low for this movie, not only the fact that it's a third Bad Robot movie, but given the roots of all the chaos they had getting out of the gate with it, the writing and all that, and racing the clock for a deadline, that I just think that this bar has been set so low on expectations that we may all be pleasantly surprised. So
well that's
see.
What the title means, Larry. They're going to easily go beyond your expectations.
Beyond the low bar. Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, that's everything that we have in news. So let's go ahead and bring in Zachary and Shar and talk about Friday's Child.
I can't wait.
awaits the unborn child.
When we think of Klingons in the original series, we tend to think of episodes like Errand of Mercy, or Day of the Dove, or The Trouble with Tribbles. One episode in particular that includes Klingons tends to get overlooked, and that's Friday's Child, particularly since the Klingon warship that was in the path of the Enterprise was merely an orange blob when this episode first aired, something that was changed in the remastered, which we'll talk about a bit later. But Larry here calls this episode undervalued, and today we're going to find out why. And to help us do that, we're joined by Trek FM executive producer and co-host of To the Journey.
To the Journey!
Of course, it is Charlene Schmidt. Hey, Char.
Hello, hello.
Good to have you here. Also joining us, associate producer here on The Ready Room and co-host of our newest show, Metatrex. It's Zachary Frueling. Hey, Zachary.
Hey, Chris. How you doing? It's great to be back on The Ready Room, and I'm still coming down off the high of launching Metatrex this week, so it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's been a great, successful launch. A lot of good feedback on the show, so congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. It feels great. It's been months in the making. It's great to just officially be a part of Trek FM.
Welcome. And there's no high like a launching high. Just, just saying by definition. So.
It's true. You're going to be forever chasing that moment from this point forward.
It's all downhill from here. Right?
So today we're going to talk about Friday's Child. And before we do that, I think we should do a synopsis because this is, as I said, an episode that tends to get overlooked. I watched this episode last year when I was just rewatching TOS, but it's one of the episodes I've seen probably the least number of times of all the original series episodes, which of course I know, Larry, that's why you want to talk about it, right?
Yeah, I dawned on me a while back that a little ways, well, about 10 years ago, actually, but how you go along, there's a time when you're a fan of something, it's harder now with social media, but in the good old days when you found something and you're just kind of in your own little bubble of loving it, and then you might find a book or a magazine or something, but you find, you have all these own opinions, and you go out and then you finally find a club or a convention, and you know, in the old days when you had to do your fandom live, or you had a zine or you correspond or whatever, now it's social media, but there comes a time when you had all these original ideas and opinions, big, small, in the middle. And you go out and start mixing with them, and there's somewhere along the way, most of the time, obviously, if you share a passion for something, you're on the same wavelength as everybody else. But there are still like little nooks and crannies and blind spots where you go, oh, okay. And Friday's Child was one of those. I'm bopping along for years and years and years and years, and we're in LA and all the, and then I kind of stumble across the fact that most people don't really see what the big deal is with this episode. And I was always like, well, what do you mean? And it kind of,
well, we will get to that. We're going to talk about.
So I'll save that for later. But that's where I come. That's where I come from with Friday.
But yeah, so you were surprised that people overlooked this episode.
I'm glad we somehow tied you up and sat you down and made you watch this poor show again after apparently.
I've watched it now twice since yesterday, so I definitely know this episode now. So synopsis, real quick here: what happens in this episode if you haven't seen it? And there's a good chance you haven't seen it in a long time. The Enterprise visits Capella 4, and this is a planet where Bones has been before, and the Capellans are these, they're supposed to be like giants, so they, of course, put the actors in platform shoes and put big hats on them so they look really big, but the Federation needs this rare mineral called topoline, and it's available on this planet, so they go there to try to get a mining agreement. They get a lot of mining agreements in the original series, right? They're going to get a mining agreement to get topoline. Well, they arrive and they find out the Klingons are already there, and the Klingons also want to have topoline. I hear that it's really good mixed into ractogeno.
Now this
it
is
actually sounds like a prescription drug, if you ask me. Ask your doctor about topoline.
The thing was, Capella 4's topoline is not just, you know, your middle-of-the-road topoline. It's top-of-the-line topoline.
It's the good stuff.
It's right. The good
is
stuff.
Is this that explosive pebble from the episode? It's good in your coffee.
It'll wake you up.
They go there and they find out that they're not really prepared, even though they did have a briefing before they visited the planet about the customs and Bones told them what they need to do. They find out they're really not prepared for the customs of this society. They get themselves into a bit of trouble, and there's also an internal battle amongst the Capellans over should they go with the Federation? Should they go with the Klingons? And there's a power struggle. And Kirk, Spock, and Bones get all mixed up in this. Along the way, Bones ends up having to deliver the baby, who would be the next ruler. And also Kirk and Spock get to craft some weapons, which is always fun in the original series, and also take out the Capellans while trying to be friends with other Capellans. Sounds a little bit convoluted, right? It makes more sense when you watch it, but that's the basic idea. They do succeed in the end. Everything is okay. The baby is born. The Federation gets the mining rights, and they get a little joke in at the end so that they can laugh to close out the episode, because that's what we do on the original series. All right, so initial
And you
thoughts.
Have a problem with this?
This isn't news, yeah.
So initial thoughts on the episode. Zachary, what are your first thoughts here?
Like you, I think I've skipped this episode as more times than I can count. I can probably count on one hand the number of times I've seen it. I probably haven't seen it in 10 years until I watched it twice today, once this morning and once right before the show. And I'm trying to think why that is. It's a really campy episode in a lot of ways. You have these the Capellans that are dressed up in these fuzzy carpet shag 1960s outfits. They're colorful. They look like Muppets in space. So, you know, when you're just sort of looking at the episode, you just don't want to watch this one. You know, I've got a list of 50 other episodes I like more than this one. Until today, though, I've got to say that as I watched it again twice today, I think I'm with Larry on this one. It's an underrated episode in a lot of ways. And it's got some wonderful things in it. We see some different sides of McCoy that we haven't, we don't necessarily see all the time. We see the side of him that loves babies, and also the side of him that slaps women when confronted. We get to see Scotty in command of the Enterprise. So this one is really climbing the charts for me. It's becoming one of my more favorite Star Trek episodes. Let's call it number 15 on my list now.
Wow.
How about you, Char?
Well, I don't want to be the negative Nancy on this panel, but this one doesn't impress me that much. It's okay. It's worth a watch. But I think, like you guys, I've not watched it in a good long time. Probably when the remastered DVDs first came out, I got them, and that might have been the last time I watched this episode. I think a lot of why I don't necessarily like this episode has to do if I question the foundation of the episode in the first place, which has to do with, okay, these are kind of a medieval type people. They don't seem terribly civilized and certainly not capable of space travel. So how are they interacting with both the Federation and the Klingons? I want to know the backstory of that. And without that knowledge, I really wonder what they're doing, because if they're trying to get mining rights, that seems really exploitive. And I don't like that one bit. I have to let that go to keep watching this episode, and that makes me grit my teeth and take it down a notch from the get-go. Sorry, Larry. However, there are some good things to like in here. I do like seeing Bones playing diplomat in a way, prepping Kirk and Spock for the away mission, doing what he does on the planet. You can't just put any other crew member on the away team and do his part. You know, it's unique to him, and that's nice. And also, Scotty in command is great. And I love the coda at the end of this one. Poor Spock is just, I mean, he's really trying to control his seething hatred for what Kirk and Bones are doing to him. Just, you insufferable bastards are going to make my life hell for the next month. I know this. So that was fantastic.
Char, I think I heard a little Janeway in you right there. That seems exploitive, and I don't like that one bit.
That's right. End of debate.
I was going to ask you to do your impression of Ellien saying McCoy.
Oh yeah. That was one of my favorite things. Is it's not McCoy, it's McCoy.
Mm-hmm. McCoy.
She has a very awesome particular way of saying it. And that was endearing. But those things aside, it's not an awful episode. I'm just not a huge fan of it based on the foundation. It makes it hard to carry on.
All right. So, Larry, before you hyperventilate there, I'm going to let you jump in and we're going to transition to the first real topic, which is...
Convince me, Larry.
Is this the most undervalued TOS episode?
No, I think so. Some of you have touched on some of this, but there's a really For one thing, this is a Dorothy Fontana episode. It's her third or fourth one. And just rereading some of the history of the evolution of it, it was really a lot darker. She was really trying to do Elaine's role as really a unique woman for the 60s television. And if you think she already is, originally it was going to be a lot darker. She was going to like give up the baby to save herself. And she really had a lot more negative qualities just to be out there kind of guest role. Just so that she wasn't a mom, apple pie, all-American mama with a baby disguised in, you know, an alien black gown with tall guys with carpet running around her. And they're aliens. But it was even interesting to see. And I'm doing some kudos here to Mark Cushman, who got back into the memos, which, you know, were 60s memos, which are hard to get into in the archives of libraries where they were donated. But what just as a final product, yes, my McCoy, you know, love. I just love the fact that, not just the fact that McCoy is giving it, but we finally actually see a cultural briefing before a landing party, you know, which I don't think that happens anywhere else in the series. So that's interesting. And I just remember there's a certain point where I got old enough, we can talk about this later, there's a certain point where there's a symmetry in the writing, and I just went, oh, she wrote that way. And it was very cool. And it was a very, not just a McCoy moment, it was a very Kirk with Spock and with McCoy separately moment, that when you go back and watch it, you go, oh, duh, it's like it's right there. But I just remember, it's kind of one of those things when you start picking up the puns in The Wizard of Oz that you didn't get when you were a little kid. You know, when you went, oh, he said a horse of a different color. Oh, that's a pun. You know, and when you're eight, you don't get that. And there was a moment like that for me in this. And of course, there's, you know, I'm a doctor, not an escalator. And there's a lot of good bits in there. Char, I don't we can get in this later, but I don't understand what the thing about the mine. They're not taking the mineral from them. They're coming in to negotiate with them. So
right, but what are they going to give them? More stone knives and bear skins, more shag.
Well, no, they were
going to
give them medicine. That's what they had given.
But they don't want medicine.
Right. Well, that's going to be their, well, maybe now that they have got a new air, now that they control the puppet. No, okay. The king and his mother, and they've turned her.
But Charlie really made a really good point that it's...
What's really kind of amazing also about this show is it's the fourth one shot for the second season. So this is before George left to go do the Green Berets. So he's actually there with Walter, with Chek. So Sulu and Chekhov are in the show together, and both on the bridge, neither one on the landing party. Yes, landing party. But... there are a lot of firsts with this show. Everything from the characters to scene pieces and props to the Klingons. And we can talk about that later on. But
it's the first time we see all seven of the characters together.
Right. Counting Sulu on the viewer in that first scene. But you know, we talk about that because the original series, a lot of it, unless we're thinking, oh, it's very, very early or it's very, very late third season, yucky poo. Oh my God, oh, how unfortunate. And a lot of other aspects of the series kind of blur together. And we basically know this is the second season. But this is really early. In fact, I was reading here today, this would have been the 30th episode of season one if they hadn't had an episode chopped at the end of the first season. So this was in the pipeline for a while, and it was the fourth one shot. But this is the first time the Chekhov, the Russian joke, is in dialogue. This is the first time in a long time, maybe the first time was... Pop and Jay Fox, Taste of Armageddon. This might be the second time the second time Scotty's in command. So some of these things that are kind of memes and tropes are not that way yet. And this is only the second Klingon show. You're talking about all the ones we think about with the big... This is only the first time after Errand of Mercy they thought to have the Klingon... Because Gene wrote it in after... It was not in Dorothy's original... draft, and they had an encounter at the end, but the idea that there was a Klingon agent at the beginning and all the way through the plot line, and that Mob was not just a horrible, you know, terroristic tribal leader, but that he has basically they all came down and said this is an excellent show, but it's really, there were people like dying right and left, and they weren't red shirts, they were like natives and everything, and they cleaned up the body count a little bit and made them, gave everybody a little bit of honor and courage where they didn't have it in the beginning. And there was a moment apparently where Dorothy wanted her name back to her pseudonym, her Michael Richards name, and Gene Coon talked her out of it. And then basically everybody's happy, but apparently Dorothy still would have liked to have seen her original darker version on this. But I, you know, Anyway, I don't know if I talked you back off the limb there, Char, but...
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm still fuzzy on exactly what it was, but I guess we can get back to that.
Going back to Chekhov making the Russian joke, what's interesting about this being the first time that it happens is the laugh that he has to himself after he says it, because I've... You watch along the way, depending on when you see him make these comments, it becomes a thing where it's like he really thinks that Russians invented everything. Like, that's the joke at the time that this was written, that, oh, you know, the motherland, we made everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other times where you get the feeling that, yeah, he's just doing it to harass his crewmates. And here, that's exactly how it feels, because he's like, I got him really good right there. That was a funny one. But it's the first time, right?
Snickering on the bridge, that he does it.
Yeah. He was laughing the hardest at his joke.
Right. It's only funny to you, Pavel.
Right. The Russian invention. Yeah.
So when you talk about undervalued elements, Larry, are you talking mainly about things like the character moments for Bones, what he gets to do, and the symmetry that you talked about?
Yeah, I'm talking about the sum total of the show. Well, here's the thing. I don't remember how old I was or where, but there's a moment in the middle when basically, you know, it's Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and the Trinity really gets to shine here. And it kind of shifts back and forth. I mean, you were talking at first almost like this was a Klingon show. And of course, to me, this is a McCoy show and everything else is kind of secondary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
but
this is a McCoy show.
It's a McCoy show where they deign to let... I mean, to me, For the World is Hollow, I don't even think of that as a McCoy show. This is what I think of as a great McCoy show. I think Sitting on the Edge, I think of that almost half of, as a great McCoy show. But a DeForest Kelly performance piece, maybe I should say. But... Aside from the fact that it's McCoy who's doing, aside from the fact that we have a cultural landing party briefing, that it's McCoy who's leading it, and you get just some depth and texture about, oh yeah, I was here for 2 months a few years back, and there's been a little bit made, you know, continuity of the fact that here's some old footage, and he's wearing a post second pilot uniform. When it was 5 years ago, it should have been a Puerto Man. But they did go to the trouble to give him a lieutenant's braid and not a lieutenant commander in that. So it's kind of like,
You know, we get that same thing in the book Shadows on the Sun. We get the same thing where they're going to a planet and it's Bones who knows about the planet because he had been there before and he has to do the whole cultural briefing again to prepare them the same way.
One of the early, back when I actually read the pro novels, but one of the really early ones, it was one that Howard Weinstein wrote called The Covenant of the Crown. And it reminds me a lot of this because it's the three of them on a planet dealing with a royal, young, like princess type. And they're trying to protect her to get her coronated or something. Anyway, but it has a lot of this kind of Dorothy Fontana, you know, the Trinity and McCoy kind of in a key role working along. But anyway, but back to Friday's Child. It's that, and then they're on the planet, and yeah, there's a rebellion, and it's this. I mean, my metaphor for this was always like Topolin and nomads in a hot planet was always like oil in the Mideast, especially pre-70s Mideast and you know, and the rise of terrorism and of the modern age. But back when the Brits and the Americans all ran all the oil companies before the locals nationalized their oil companies. And I mean, that's what it, I can get a little bit of the exploitative part there, but it looks like they're trying to at least live up the fact that they're trying to negotiate with them. But the moment I was talking about that really got me was there's the bit where they're on the defensive. Basically, it's McCoy's off doing his job, Spock is off doing his job, and Kirk is checking on both of them. And outdoors, Spock is trying to do his bow and arrow. And I love the line about this is going to come as big a shock as fireworks, you know, gunpowder was to Europeans. Mm-hmm. And in the cave, McCoy is trying to not only birth the baby, but teach the mom not to kill it, right? To turn her into some kind of maternity. And both times when he's talking to both of them, they're griping, I can't do this, this is pointless, this is hopeless. And Kirk, I swear to God, basically says to both of them, oh, I'm sorry, Bones / Mr. Spock, sometimes I guess I expect too much out of you. And they both are like, well, I didn't say that, you know, and then he leaves. So he does that with McCoy first, then he goes outside and Spock's griping about the bows and having to cut these arrows. And forgive me, Mr. Spock, sometimes I expect too much out of you. And he's like, oh, And it's just really, and it doesn't slap you in the face, but I was like, oh, and I just remember that being one of the first times I went, oh, look, there's structure in the writing. Oh, that's just a, I didn't mean to make such a big deal out of it, but it just came along. I just will always remember noticing that. Like I said, like when you notice something on a new level and something that you've watched before and then you go, oh, new eyes. But even all the way down to the meme of, yeah, one of the bad parts is that young red shirt that gets killed just for being stupid, just because they wanted a teaser, you know, music cue stinger. Yeah. Dum, dum, dum. Yeah. You know, a Klingon.
He deserved to die.
But in his defense, it was only the first time they had seen Klingons since Erin DeMersey, or we had anyway. So
true, but looking at our own world, when you just act more on instinct, never mind the fact that you're a trained security officer.
Well, I would think in addition to cultural briefings on the ship, they would actually brief the red shirts. Like, here are some things you might not want to do when we beam down to the planet.
Grab your phaser for their little
Don't
wooden...
pull your phaser out.
Yeah, their killer wooden weapons. No, but then on the other hand, it's almost like already by now they're meme busting because, A, I love the line when he says, oh, come on, Mr. Spock, the cavalry doesn't always ride over the hill to the rescue anymore. You know, the thing about, oh, Deus Machina here coming in with our security guard. But then they do, which is kind of...
they do.
Which they're, it's like they're mocking themselves. And then when they do, nobody dies. So... there's
go
at least
figure.
There's 8 or 10 red shirts in that scene, and nobody gets killed. So they've already lost one. So and there's other little things all the way through the show too. But just the comedy. I know Gene Kuhn lost his job later on over injecting humor into Trek. But in the when they're all functioning on all gears, and Gene and Dorothy and Bob Justman wrote a ton of memos. Bob Justman, speaking of being undervalued, wasn't just a producer, line producer guy. He did all kinds of story content and doesn't always get credit for that. Just like he actually pitched the story for Tomorrow Is Yesterday with Captain Christopher, the Air Force pilot, and Gene didn't ever give him credit for it, and it's kind of sad. But his notes about making Elian too unlikable, and there's nothing redeeming about her, and trying to inject an element of honor and courage into all the characters' arcs, if you go back and read some of that, he really had a lot to do with molding the early part of this, aside from griping that they had to cut stuff because the budget was going to be blown. But it's just a great show. And in bottom line is, in showcasing McCoy, it elevates Kirk and Spock also. And then Scotty doing his thing on the bridge was also, again, not a trope by then. It was only about the second time it had been done. And watching the little four, running around on the bridge together, and watching New Chekhov is kind of interesting. So remembering where this was, even the Sulu scope made its premiere in this episode. So
Sulu scope. Is that trademarked?
I don't know. I heard somebody call it. I always called it the Viewmaster, but that's
I kind of want to pop up microphone like that.
That's a time and place apart.
We need those for when we podcast.
That would be awesome for Trek FM.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be like
be my welcome present
like
for Metatrex. There you go.
If we're going to record... All right, let's get ready to go.
The microphones come up.
We need that.
We do. So I want to talk about Scotty a little bit. But before that, Zachary, Char, any thoughts on the character stuff that Larry's been talking about here?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of have a love-hate relationship with the original series. It has big highs and big lows for me. It's really deep and brilliant sometimes. It can be really campy and ridiculous at other times. And a few weeks ago on The Ready Room, I think it was 185, The Trouble with Tribbles, we were talking about the fact that episode is a microcosm of all of the original series, right? It has a little bit of every character, the humor, you've got the Klingons. It's just a miniature of the entire series. And this episode reminds me of that. You have a little bit of everything in this episode. You've got a red shirt dying. You've got the Kirk, Spock, McCoy trio. You've got some depth when you have when you consider the issues with cultural relativism and how and what the their Capellan's attitude should be towards this child that Elian gives birth to. So we have the foundations of the Russian joke. We've got Scotty in command, on and on and on. All the things that Larry mentioned are things that become tropes for the entire series. So as I watch this again, it occurred to me, I think on a surface viewing, it's a really campy episode with colorful carpet Muppet creatures. you know, with ninja star weapons, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so, but that's the thing. It, for me, it's a love-hate relationship. I love some of the campiness of the original series at the same time. Sometimes it just makes me roll my eyes, and other times I go, this is so much fun. It's an adventure out in space. And, you know, sometimes you're going to get those wacky World of the Weeks. It's like WWW, wacky World of the Week. And that's what you get in this episode. And that's what it's like to be on the frontier sometimes. Yeah. I love it.
I think at the time, and if I try to remember back to watching this when I was a kid in the 70s as well, this stuff, this adventure out in space and encountering these types of cultures and the things that we see happening in the episode worked a little bit better for us back then. You know, today in 2015, we're colored more by the evolution of science fiction and our own knowledge of space and our own technology that we have now. And it seems a lot campier than it did at the time.
Yeah, it was more of an adventure story back in the 70s. And, you know, frankly, it feels like maybe we need a little bit of that again. You know, we're discovering more and more planets out in the universe. You know, who knows what they're going to be like, you know, just injecting a little bit of fun and mystery. You know, Star Trek was really good at that back in the 60s. And, you know, I miss that a little bit in entertainment.
Well, if we detect one covered with carpet and fur, it could be Capella 4.
Wouldn't be shag carpet now. Now it would be nice, you know, speckled carpet.
It was really interesting, the kind of things that, I mean, that we talk about camp in the 60s, and some of that is just time and budget and just the sheer energy they had to exert just to get something like this. I mean, this was made at a time, not just when they were dealing with, you know, ratings and money and time budget, but there was an attitude, and the space program was going. This was done, you know, Mercury had gone into Gemini and we were headed to the moon, hopefully, but it hadn't permeated the culture. I mean, it was way before. I mean, the 80s were still like that, for God's sake. And we didn't have Big Bang Theory, you know, number one show, and Comic-Con was not a business model that every city in the country drooled over having in their own town, you know, for sales tax and tourist dollars. And just the amount of energy they had to expend to get it where it got to this. I mean, I just reminded of this because I was reading something I didn't even think about, but reading memos early on in the development of this show where they were talking about this is the first, they had, in the first season, they'd always explained away why people spoke English. It was either smart people or they had communicators or translators, you know, actually physically, like in Arena and Metamorph. And this is the first time they didn't. And they actually went back through and did a pass. Now, some people might say this was maybe a culturist thing, but they actually went back and tried to not have them have the Capellans not speak such leisurely English. And then, you know, some comment about, well, now, oh, great. Now it sounds like, you know, bad 50s Western Native Americans language or something.
Very stilted,
but,
yeah.
But they did, they at least addressed it in their thinking. And it wasn't even just the team. It was like the poor Port Robertson at NBC said something about, well, we're speaking English awfully easy. I mean, but it's just the fact of, and not that your struggle, your E for effort can only go so far. But they really, really were thinking about a lot of these things that now we kind of, you know, blow off or whatever. And they were frustrated by not being able to do, you know, more with what they had. And they would drool to have the CG and the editing facilities that they have now to, you know, to pull off, you know, kinds of things. But anyway, I just wanted to inject that because they really did. A lot of these things really did cross people's consciousness to think about. And they just couldn't do anything. They just did the best they could most of the time. At least when they were spinning on all gears, part of the spinning on all gears in the well-oiled machine was even remembering the things they tried to do and maybe couldn't pull off all the way. It was at least on the radar. It was at least on the Sulu scope of trying to do it.
Yeah, Larry, real quick, I want to make sure you just don't misunderstand me a little bit. The campiness in this episode is really not a criticism. And even of the original series in general, this is kind of the campiness I would expect from Star Trek. You know,
well, it's part of the
charm. It's part of what makes it fun to watch. And it's not something to criticize. You know, I think a lot of people use the campiness of Star Trek as a criticism. It's the reason they don't watch the original series. That's why they gravitate towards the later series, especially younger people younger than I am, right? And you know, for me, you know, I grew up watching this in syndication in the early 80s. So this is just a wonderful trip down memory lane. This is the campiness I love about the original series, and much more so than I remembered having seen this episode maybe 10 years ago.
Well, at the same time, and speaking of Julie Newmar, when I think of campy, I think of like Batman, 60s Batman, as being campy. with a, you know, like they don't even like wink at the camera. They just go for it, you know, and and Star Trek at its worst is maybe square jawed Dick Tracy, you know, kind of a, that kind of bit, that maybe like Jack Webb a little bit. But when they leaven everything with, they round off the corners and they have the, you know, Scotty and Sulu and Chekhov and who are bantering and Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, but you know, and that look that McCoy, that Spock gives McCoy, you know, when he says, yeah. He just looks up. It's just such a standard, you know, humor, piece of humor in a 1 hour drama kind of take that he puts it through his Vulcan filter and gets to give back at him. Like, oh, really? You know, well, I'll see your cute, I'll see your cute tag to come and zing you right here with this look.
Yeah, we expect, you know, Spock to be able to zing you without any words. And he does that in this episode.
He exactly. does. Exactly. I think my favorite scene in this episode was where, how do you say her name?
Eliane. Because on Capella 4, the 10 tribes all have two vowels at the middle that you say separately, like Ma'ab and Eliane and Tier. Yeah. Okay.
You would be Sha'ar if you lived.
I got to say, I have this mental block against remembering the names in this episode. I wrote them all
Me
down
too.
Phonetically
I
so I could
trouble.
Remember them.
I watched it twice just to absorb half of them. I don't understand. Okay, so Eliane.
My brain just doesn't work this way. Yeah.
Where she's. So pick up. Yeah. Where she finally got
it's because
to.
Because they're aliens.
Right, right. I figured that's where that was coming from.
That's how you know.
They didn't get a Z or an X in there like you get in 1970s sci-fi. Though.
Right. No. Right. For that time.
What was that story where this character, it wasn't Zahn, but it was another character. And I think it was you, Zachary. I asked you, is it an X or a Z? And you said it's both.
It was actually both. Yeah, right next right. to each other. Yeah, it was from I think it was from the original script of Devil's Due. Yeah.
Oh, maybe. All right, go ahead, Char. Sorry
okay. So the scene where Eliane takes McCoy's hand and says, "Oh, it's so soft." And Spock manages to glance at him and McCoy sees Spock and just, "Get out of here. This is my moment."
So that moment, the look that Spock gives for me feels odd for Spock because it's this look, it's an emotional look. It's this sort of kind of disgusted, I'm kind of disappointed in you. It's a look that I could see one of the other characters give Bones, but...
Really? I didn't get that at all.
No?
It was more like, oh, I walked in on a moment of tenderness. This is interesting.
Oh, I didn't get that at all. I got
Oh,
like,
I just saw a cheap
I'm really,
joke
really disappointed in you, Bones.
Why would he be
this
disappointed?
Is not conduct befitting
it
of an officer.
It looked like total disapproval to me, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I might have to go back and watch it, because I'm not getting it, that.
I took it totally for, wait till I get you back on. I mean, I just...
Yeah, it was more like that.
Now, you're talking about the look when he's holding her hand, right?
Yes, Spock yes.
Right, and they're out in the lake. Spock hand away comes along the way. Yeah, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay, interesting.
So we have two totally different opinions on one look. On this is interesting.
All right. Okay. We'll let people in the Babel Conference be the tiebreaker on this.
Yeah, let them fight it out.
Yeah.
It's that, really, Doctor, you really must learn to control your passions kind of look, you know?
And he's not, true. Like, Spock wasn't even aware of the slap at that point, right? I mean, I love
right,
the
that
fact that, yeah, that we haven't discussed the slap where that actually is what gets Eliane to trust him. You know what I think really happened is McCoy was not aware that the slap doubled as a marriage ceremony. In my head canon, that's the truth. And once he finally did it, he's like, okay, it's your baby now.
Yeah.
So maybe.
You're
going to
raise it.
Not biologically, just legally.
No. Well, yeah. It's your baby. It's your responsibility. And that way I don't have to deal with this thing.
So maybe, Char, I have a theory here now in reading the history books and learning this, that maybe Harry Kim did pick up on that. So that way he could try to get people on the ship like the Delaney sisters to slap him because that would be the only way that he's ever going to get one.
And sadly, it only works on this world. He should have watched Bob's Burgers, though. Do you guys watch that show where the little child, the smallest child, Louise, she slaps people she loves the most to get through them. Like, hey, snap out of it. It's a sign of love for her. But most of the time, it doesn't work that way at all. On this planet, maybe it does work the way I think Louise would work well here. The rest of the time, Harry, you are sadly mistaken. I don't know. If you don't watch Bob's Burgers, you probably have no clue what I'm talking about. I'm sorry. It's a great show. I've been binging on it.
However, Shar, I will say I haven't seen Bob's Burgers, but I have watched Bob's Burgers, which is very popular on Capella 4.
Are they wearing the tasseled uniforms?
You must be watching the Americanized version there, because I was watching the original, Chris, and I was watching Bob's Burgers. So,
Wow. So there are moments in this episode where I feel like Aka-R is calling Ma'ab Bob. It's like, like, are we going to do this in front of the humans and the Klingons, Bob? Do you want to fight me right now?
It's but amazing anybody's left on that planet, how much they want to fight each other and die.
Here's one more thing I want to throw out here for you guys. Recasting this episode, because I know you guys like to do this on To the Journey with things, with series and such. I think that Ma'ab should be played by Will Ferrell.
Yeah!
Doesn't this... That's a winner!
I vote for that. I want to see him in the One Piece jumpsuit thing with...
Okay.
I'm on board.
I'm just...
Larry does not know what to say.
No, I'm just... take Ma'ab. I'm just trying to think of who would recast L.A.N. Because if one thing we haven't said about this episode yet... Three words. Julie freaking Newmar.
Yes, okay. But Larry, before you realize that it's Julie Newmar, when she first comes into the tent, I almost thought it was a Star Trek I Dream of Jeannie crossover episode.
There are some really weird moments. And when the other girl comes in and McCoy like says, oh, don't... She's like, it's like she's got the backup Jeannie outfit on. The one that he says, don't touch her because it'll be a marriage proposal. Yeah. Yeah, actually, the genie bottle on the last episode of Star Trek Continues on Kirk's bed shelf is not a throwback to I Dream a Genie. It's really a throwback to Friday's Child to I Dream a Genie.
It's a throwback to a throwback.
It's a throwback to a throwback. Yeah.
To a crossover.
So recasting this episode, as I think about this, all the Capellans, since they're all tall and they're all blonde and they have ponytails, I'm going to say Fabio.
Fabio.
There you go.
And then he'd say, I can't believe it's not Topoline.
But we wouldn't be able to see his beautiful hair because it's all covered up, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well,
they got those ponytails sticking out the back.
I guess.
Yeah, I think for him, he could have it sticking out the back. Yeah.
All right.
Okay, we're really off on something else over here now. Before we get too far away from the character stuff, because I do want to have time to talk about the Klingons as well.
They have barditches on Capella 4, and we've skidded into one really bad here. Okay.
Right. With Scotty, I love when Scotty's in command, because I think Scotty generally does a really nice job of being in command of the ship. In this situation, did you guys feel like they fell for the Klingon trap of the distress call too easily, and it took them way too long to figure out what was going on? Because my immediate reaction would have been, let's verify this signal.
Yes.
Because
thank you.
It's basically the Kobayashi Maru test all over again, right?
Yeah, the whole time, my brain, I was saying to Scotty, it's a fake.
Right? But then they get there and they're waiting around. And at this point, surely they figured out that someone's trying to keep them away from the planet. But no, they're going to stay and look around a little bit more.
Yes, and don't call me
Shirley. Yeah.
Sorry.
I thought, a little bit weak in the writing, personally.
Well, it doesn't make sense. You know, if they're going to stick around, they're going to wait to see that it's a trap. And then if it's a trap, then what? You know, if you know they're trying to lure you away from the planet, why not just go back to the planet?
Yeah. Why did they hang around?
Right.
It did not
because
make any sense.
Because of
the
risk of it being a... You know,
an authentic distress call.
I felt like that was a really weak point, and Uhura looked weak trying to bring it. Well, what if it is real, Scotty? No, it's not. You uncovered the truth already. Just go.
Oh, I know, right? Once they figured it out, they're heading back. But this one could be real. This might be the one we've been waiting for.
Yeah, no.
No.
You have to set save up the checkoff joke, right?
Scotty has to show up George Bush and be able to say, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. Correctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So that was a quick little bit about Scotty. But otherwise, I don't know. I like when Scotty is in command, though. I think he's a pretty capable commander.
I think it's a shame what happens to him later in Star Trek lore, right? I mean, in the Star Trek movies, he almost becomes comic relief, right? And so in the original series here, in an example like this, he's in command and he's really good at it. He's a capable commander. You can picture him as captain of the Enterprise. But, you know, by the time the movies roll around, he's largely comic relief. And it's a disservice to the character, I think.
That may be partly because of him just gaining the weight and showing the age a little bit, where he like becomes more teddy bear than tough guy, maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean the you know, right tool for the right job, Clang, or I know this ship like the back of my head, Clang is just really over the top, but a lot of him's hero, in fact, he almost reclaims a little bit of that in the Generations prologue, mm-hmm. where he's, you know, on the bridge and they leave him back. Mm-hmm. I just try to have a blind side to that and think of tough guy heroic Scotty here.
I like seeing it's refreshing.
It's interesting how we remember different characters, because with Scotty, maybe you prefer the original series Scotty, whereas with Kirk, for me personally anyway, I have always connected better with the movie Kirk than the original series Kirk. So it does depend on the character.
I could see that. Yeah.
So about this show, I've totally lost track of our outline.
Yeah.
This is also totally apart from the characters and story. Oh my God. This is the other Vasquez Rocks show.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And you can very much go. Yeah, you can very much go out there and you can go on this side. And we've done this on our Geek Nation tour out there. You can go over here and relive the whole Gorn fight. Then you come back over. If you're driving it in a car, it's on your left and on the side before you go down into the clearing where most of the Gorn fight was. But over, in fact, this last trip, and you can go online and on the Facebook and see it, we had guys that, and girls that brought their communicators, and they recreated the whole, you know, use a communicator for a sympathetic vibration feedback and cause an avalanche. We found the table rock, the walkway where their caravan is coming up single file. It's also the same area where the Oogie Uchikuchikuchiku bits and the Spock take and all that. All of that happened on this kind of shelf area mm-hmm. out there. Some of this was filmed indoors. The cave area was filmed on stage back at Desilu. But all the outdoor bits were just on the other side of the passway back at Vasquez also. But again, this is the show that nobody thinks about for Vasquez after the Gorn and the Tilt Rock.
So I'm thinking, Chris, when you come to the United States for Star Trek Las Vegas next year, we need to meet up at Vasquez Rocks and recreate these scenes.
We should.
Put it on the calendar.
One of the powers of Vasquez Rocks, which is proven now by this episode together with Arena, is that when you're in the vicinity of Vasquez Rocks, you gain the ability to fabricate weapons.
Apparently so, good point.
Lying around.
Yeah.
They just have stuff strewn about all over the place there. It's part of the experience.
Branches, paper mache, whatever.
We also know that all the boulders there are, in fact, made of styrofoam.
Styrofoam.
It has been
just going for the mountains themselves, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's on the Geek Nation tours you're mentioning there, Larry, if anyone wants to go try to find that.
We had we specifically hunted that. We had some guys that really wanted to recreate that, and they all brought their Kirk Gold and their their Spock Blues and their hero. And I should say, too, another cool thing about this is we mentioned it's the appearance of the Sulu Viewmaster, the Sulu scope. This shot, speaking of Table Rock in that same scene, this has the best hero footage and the best hero looks of the hero communicator with the moray pattern. Mm-hmm. This is the one that people go, and you can see the little spring watch winding stem on it, and people have used those stills in that footage for ages to do the pattern and all that. So there's one for the tech heads and the prop meisters.
One quick question, Larry. Now, people tried to recreate the scene of creating the sound wave and making the avalanche. No one tried to actually give birth inside the cave there, right?
No, we waited till we were back on the studio tour.
Okay.
And brought along the fake cave set.
Okay. All right.
Before we tried that.
Because I thought that might be going a little bit too far with trying to recreate.
Yeah, plus it was hot out there and everything. Yeah. So, yeah, no.
Okay, well, like you said, we've lost track of our outline here, so let's jump back on, because there's a couple of things here that I want to touch on before we run out of time. And going all the way back to the beginning, when we talked about the Klingons being in this episode, and you mentioned, Larry, that maybe the way I described it at first almost sounded like this is a Klingon episode, but it's a Bones episode. It's not that I think of it as a Klingon episode, but the Klingons, it's interesting to me that over time, we think of the Klingons as having always been there, the constant enemy in Star Trek mm-hmm. throughout the original series, when actually there are not very many episodes in the original series with Klingons.
No.
And this is one of the episodes that does include Klingons, and it's an episode that I really think people forget entirely that the Klingons were even
here. Yeah. Well, and again, Erin DeMercy was late in the first season. Okay, so Erin DeMercy was the 27th show. You had City and then Operation Annihilate. And then filming, now not airing, but filming-wise, Cat's Paw, Metamorphosis, Friday's Child, Who Mourns for Adonis, and Amok Time, Doomsday Machine, Wolf in the Fold, Changeling, the Apple. Wait, I just went right past it. Friday's Child. This is the first time that the Klingons are reused. And if you're looking at the evolution of the show, they wanted an element. The Klingons were originally just at the end, and then Gene wanted them worked all the way through. But they were still very much into the whole, you know, Erin DeMercy left things with a stalemate and with this superior being race overseeing everything. Mm-hmm. So they really had to, you think of this and you think of Private Little War, where you really had this proxy. Plus, it was cheaper to have one Klingon than a whole flock of Klingons. But a swarm of Klingons, I guess, unless you save it for Tribbles. But this was the only time, I think, I'm checking real fast. The next time we had a Klingon was Koloth and the Tribbles. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you had Private Little War's agent. And then that was it for the end of the season. Oh, Omega Glory. No, that was all Starfleet all the time. The only two times you had... The three times you had Klingons in the second season were this show, Tribbles, and Private Little War. So, the only reason you had that many Klingons was because Romulans had those damn helmets and had ear tips. I mean, out of the gate, the Romulans were going to be the recurring aliens, but yeah. Klingons were cheaper. But even then, as you said, they weren't in every third week. There were only three times in second season. So, yeah, this is why it's good for us to all get out and dust off our memories and remember where things were chronologically and then step back and look at statistics. So this whole thing of having the lone agent who was negotiating was basically the writer's way of getting Klingons into it as a danger, but having it be true to the whole Organian peace treaty mm-hmm. bit. And then, of course, the next time you see Klingons, they even bring it up in dialogue, you know, and they kind of verbalize what they've been operating with. So, yeah, so the Klingons are far from being a trope and a meme and a stereotypical thing here. I mean, by now the transporter hasn't even messed up often, even at this point.
Right.
So yeah, so it's almost like a snapshot in, you know, looking when the world was new with Star Trek background and these things weren't set in stone, and that the Klingon agent was even a last minute addition, wasn't even organically part of the story.
You know, to me, he doesn't even feel very Klingon. What about you, Shar?
I have to agree. There were times when he wasn't Klingon at all. Like when he says to Kirk, look, we want the mining right. We want mining rights too. We need this mineral. You know, a lot of times Klingons are not that forthcoming and did brutally honest like that. It just really struck me as strange. So little moments like that seemed really inconsistent, but there's not a whole lot of Klingon development at this point. So
true. He doesn't have a lot to go by. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, those augment Klingons, you know, they were just always a little flaky when they...
Yeah, they were their own thing, yeah.
It's actually a little hard for me to watch the Klingons in this episode. And part of it's that I feel like I grew up on 24th century Klingons. And we've observed several times on the network that the Klingons in the original series kind of changed place with the Romulans. And when I watch this episode, mm-hmm. the Klingons feel more like Romulans feel in the 24th century, right? You've got this cat and mouse game with the ships cloaking and decloaking. Mm-hmm. You've got a swarthy, smooth talking Klingon. And that just feels more like the Romulans feel in the 24th century. So I just, it does, there's a bit of cognitive dissonance for me when I watch the Klingons in this episode. They don't feel like Klingons to me.
You know what, Zach? I had to fight off 24th century-ness as well watching this episode, but in a different way, where if they had encountered this planet, they wouldn't be trying to secure mining rights. They would just ignore it because prime directive.
I'm glad you mentioned that because there are some prime directive issues here, right?
Maybe a few, yeah.
A few, right. You know, you've got this issue with what I would call cultural relativism. You've got you know, Kirk basically starting a fight with the Capellans when what's her name again? Ellian?
Yeah.
None of us can get the name right.
Just Ellian. Remember, Ellian she is an alien woman, therefore she is Ellian.
when Ellian's life is being threatened, Kirk basically starts a fight, you know, rather than just letting that culture unfold as it should in its natural development, right? So Kirk's violating the Prime Directive there. We've got McCoy trying to convince Ellian to basically keep and appreciate the baby. So they're basically violating the Prime Directive left and right, and it's hard not to go back and read the Prime Directive really strongly into that episode. But it does raise these really deep issues for me of cultural relativism. And on the show notes, we haven't really talked about this, but we had planned to talk a little bit about the original script, that there were some rewrites involved in that the Ellian character was going to be sort of a darker character. She was going to sacrifice her own child to save her own life. And I almost feel like it's a shame that they didn't really push the boundaries on these issues a bit, right? If you're going to set up a culture that is different than ours in some way, where their moral intuitions conflict with our own, why not push the boundaries a little bit, right? You know, rather than Gene Roddenberry kind of playing it safe and saying, well, no, we can't have Ellian sacrificing her child because that's too... doesn't mesh with his worldview, or he can't put that on television. Why not put something like that on there? Because that really forces the issue. I mean, even in philosophy, we kind of get this example of cultural relativism that's common, where people talk about, you know, let's think of the worst possible example we can come up with, torturing babies for fun and profit, right? That's the kind of well-known cultural relativism example. That's what comes to mind when I see this episode. Why not push the boundaries a bit rather than play it safe?
Torturing babies for fun and profit sounds like a really good Ferengi episode. But you know what? Well, it would make more sense, actually, that version, a more darker Ellian who would kill her baby, because they say once in this episode, she really hates this child. She's not interested in being a mother. She does not want to be a mother. Why? We don't get any rationalization on that. And so it would just, with what little we know of that information, it would make sense that she would kill this child. Problem solved, no matter how grisly.
Right. And it might sound terrible to us, but again, put it in that culture.
Right. I mean, for her, maybe
that's what she would do.
Right.
Well, again, that was Dorothy's Dorothy Fontana's original story.
And I'm with Dorothy.
Yeah. I mean, that was her trying to make a statement about a strong woman, a strong character, and an alien attitude, an alien worldview. Mm-hmm. And even as we're sitting here criticizing this for being so watered down from the original intent and what it could have been in Ben Alien, it's still a pretty amazing show to have aired in its time and to hold up it as it is. I mean, she's still, even watered down, she's still a strong... You know, they get in the slapping match, and she does want to give away the baby, and there is a kind of a cultural worldview there, and she offers to, you've won the Civil War, you'll have to kill me now, obviously, you know, and then she gets to be snooty when she's going to have Kirk killed before she's killed because he dared to touch her, even though she's offering herself to be killed, you know, so, I mean, there's a little bit of that. And if you really step back, and we're just talking about Klingons and Romulans switching places here, and they're a little smooth talking. If you stop and think about it, it's a long way off in the future, and it had to go through makeup revisions and Ron Moore and everything, you know, 20 years later, 30 years later. But if you think about it, the Capellans are a lot of that feudal Japanese kind of attitude, you know, a little bit medieval, you know, Mediterranean, future Islamic, Arabic, whatever. They're a little bit culturally like the Klingons are always supposed to be about, not, you know, the original idea of eschewing medicine and, you know, battle and honor is, fighting is natural. And why would you not want to sacrifice yourself? And there's honor in fighting, and it's our way. I mean, it's almost like you see a little, not that it was ever a direct line between them, but some of those same tenets of what we think of now as your 24th century-ness about Klingons is kind of the roots. Not roots, but there's a straight line. But you see some of that in these Capellans. And then when you contrast that against Crass, who, by the way, Ty Gandrews, we should say, wound up being the... had been roles, but he wound up being most famous for the Mod Squad, which was Harv Bennett's little relevant youth police show. He was their gripey patient captain. But some of that just struck me. The same things we're talking here about switching places and these Klingons and these Capellans, a lot of those cultural tenets are what make up what came to be mainstream Klingon and the way it developed. Mm-hmm.
what's really bold about this issue is that, I mean, they don't even shy away from it. There's an explicit line from the show. Spock tells McCoy, virtue is a relative term, right? They're not shying away from this deeper issue. And, you know, if you have a race like this that has these radically different values, and Spock's sitting here saying virtue is a relative term, there's a tension between that and all of the sort of proactive moral choices that Kirk makes along the way, right? They put it in a line of dialogue. They have Spock force the issue.
Right. True. And if you think about it, the whole thing of the Klingons, I don't know if they, I mean, it was part of part of Errand of Mercy, but this was the first time there'd been a Klingon character since then thinking, and I can see them, the writers, all two or three of them at the time. I can see them thinking, well, we've just, it's kind of like we talk about, oh, the warp 5 speed limit, or, 21st century humans not having any inner drama, so how do you write conflict? I can see the writers sitting around going, well, we just wrote ourselves into a corner on that one. How are we ever going to do anything with the Klingons again? Or the Borg being all powerful, how would you ever meet them again? What would you do with them? And I could just see them going, well, we've just painted ourselves into a corner on that. How would we ever deal with Klingons again? Well, one way is to have like one character off as an operative and Klingons. You know, if there's one guy over here on this little planet, maybe the Organians don't see that. Ooh.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's out of their radar. Yeah,
that's
the lone
what they
wolf
did
Klingon.
With the Borg. That's why I Borg is such a good episode, because when you isolate one Borg, you can tell a different story.
But part of this is the first time I can see that almost like they've flushed it from their memory core, and then in the demand to come back and punch it up in ways they want to do, or Gene wants to do. And maybe I think some notes from the network and Bob Justman too. They go, well, let's go back at Russians. Klingons are cheaper than Romulans. Let's start to work on a little bit of, and Gene Kuhn invented the Klingon, so he's not against that. So I can see, but then that also opens the door to the old meme about if the Romulans are standing in for the Chinese and the Red Chinese of the 60s, 70s Cold War, and the Klingons are standing in for the Soviets. Cold War, and you get to back into maybe a little bit of that proxy war feel that, of course, comes full bloom in Private Little War later on. But you start off with that vibe here. And again, it's not, I mean, and that was what was going on in Errand of Mercy, and it blew up in their faces because the joke was on them, both sides. But here you've kind of got it back to that square one level of, yes, here we are both being, we've got a secret guy down there and we've got a ship. And his ship is backing him up. And, oh, we just stumbled into this. But when we're talking about, oh, it's primed, how can Kirk be doing this? Now we look at it with our 24th century eyes. And it's the ultimate thing here is, they just witnessed the Civil War. So the only way to salvage it politically for the Federation is to make sure the kid is born who will come from the mother, who we have a greater chance of siding with the Federation than these guys. You know, and then lo and behold, the guy grows up and sacrifices himself when he sees that the Klingons are just slimy slime balls. Mm-hmm. But, when you step back and remember what's the canvas this is being told against, it's told against the whole proxy war battle, and that it's early in even what we think of looking back as what Star Trek did with that. So,
And if you fast forward this story very far forward, you go into the novels, Leonard James Akar actually becomes Fleet Admiral in the DS9 relaunch series and even into the Titan novels. He's actually a very important character.
Well, see, it was a name destined for galactic greatness, Christopher.
Yeah. Well, not just a name, but a baby. A baby destined for galactic greatness.
Which, I don't know if we said this. I think maybe we touched on it. That's one of my three favorite TOS tags. And yes, it's the Laughing Flintstones ending, but it's one of the best three tag ending. And say what you will about McCoy, but you have to, if you're going to have a great original series tag ending on your show, McCoy is part of it. Just saying.
True.
Pig's Eye, I Finally Got the Last Word, and this one are the three greatest.
Says the man who has played McCoy.
I'm just saying. I'm just saying. I only say this for philosophical purposes.
Sounds oddly self-serving, Larry.
All right. Well, we have passed an hour, so let's wrap up. We did kind of jump all over our outline today, but I think we still touched on a lot of interesting points here. So let's give our final thoughts on this episode and our rating. And Char, why don't you kick us off?
my final thoughts really, after this discussion, do not change after my initial thoughts. Still not my favorite, Larry. I'm sorry. You really did highlight the good things about this episode, but, you know, if I'm going through an original series rewatch, there's so much more that's better to pick from. Please don't slap me. Please don't slap me. I'll have to slap you back.
I'll slap you anyway my technological training tells me, young lady. No.
At least you have soft hands.
Through the screen. Yeah.
There you go. But, yeah, it's just okay in my book. I feel like it has some missteps. I'm going to give it 2 McCoys.
All right. How about you, Zachary?
I was pleasantly surprised. Like I said, I hadn't seen this episode in probably a decade, and I fast-forwarded past it any number of times during my rewatches, but I really enjoyed it. I watched it twice today, and it's got a little bit of everything I like about the original series. It's got a lot of things that I don't like. I think there's some problems with the story. We mentioned some parts that don't make sense, but largely it reminds me of how 1960s Star Trek should be. It's a little campy. It's a little low budget. It's got some deeper moral issues. It's got some wonderful character interactions. So this actually moved from like the bottom of my list up to mid-range. It's not in the top 10 for me. You know, I can think of, you know, countless other episodes that I enjoy more, but it's not in the worst 10 anymore either. So I still think my original estimate that it's somewhere around number 15 for me for the original series. Now it's moved up a few notches. So given that, I think I'm going to give it a rating of 7.5 out of 10 Uchi Wuchi Gucci Goos.
All right. Okay, Larry, so it's no longer in the bottom 10 for Zach.
I know.
Final thoughts. What's your rating?
Well, first off, Char, I wasn't trying to paint this as like it should be your favorite episode. I mean, I have my top 5 and top 10, and this is probably in the top 10, but I still have Doomsday Machine and Journey to Babel and Amok Time and all of those great ones. But
fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just saying my statement was that like you were just saying, Zach, that a lot of people overlook this and should go back and maybe appreciate a lot of chunks of it. That was the whole point. That give it a look and it's undervalued. But it begins and ends as being one of the great McCoy episodes. And so if it's being undervalued by people, I want to make sure that it's understood for that. And there's a lot of fun, and it's not even all about McCoy of Scotty. Like I said, there's great Kirk and Spock moments. There's just great Star Trek building moments. And then when you factor in the filter of Klingons were new and Chekhov was new and the Sulu scope was new. And this is early second season, although it was aired like way after some of the other shows, you know, not that that matters now. But yeah, I'm just here spreading the web. In contrast or compared to anything else I'm doing in Star Trek, my mission with Friday's Child is just to give a little air and just bring it up out of the basement, out of the cellar, and let everybody like look at it again and put it back out on display in the main gallery and let everybody kind of reanalyze it if they haven't looked at it for a while.
Just remember, that's guys, Friday's Child is love and giving.
Yes, as opposed to Saturday's Child, who is heart of living or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we don't want to talk about Saturday's Child.
We don't.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's why I still, but you know, it doesn't get any better than McCoy slapping the alien princess. It dawned on me today re-watching this. What is harder in McCoy's medical bag of miracles? Slathering and helping the wound on a toxic rock creature, or taking a hard-edged Capellan woman and making her maternal? You know, when your life is at stake with both of them. So
right, because the Horda was already maternal.
That's true.
Very maternal.
That's true. That's yes. True. And the Horda wanted her babies.
She did. No one's touching her babies.
So that's why I still come back. No, it's not the best Star Trek episode ever, but it deserves a look. And that's why I give this 4. Yes, those are wooden, but those Klingons really can kill you. Klingons.
Great. Very good. Well, my thoughts on this episode are that I think it is interesting because of all the little firsts and all the little special moments that are scattered in it. It also feels like a disjointed episode to me compared to the majority of the original series episodes. This one feels very rough around the edges. The editing's rough. The pacing feels off for me as well. And I actually find that the dialogue, and maybe this is the result of it being revised a number of times because I haven't seen Dorothy's original script, but I feel like the resulting dialogue is very odd at times, and the delivery is odd. It just feels kind of very unnatural. And I try to put myself back in the mindset of, okay, well, language changes over time. And if I want to put a positive spin on my view of it there, it is the fact that language evolves, and the English that we speak today is very different than the English that was spoken in the 1960s. So structurally, maybe it sounds odd to us now, but I feel like in this episode, it feels odd even compared to other original series episodes.
Is there an example that jumps out at you? Because I hadn't.
There are a lot. It's a lot of it's just the way that even Kirk, Spock, and Bones speak to each other. Without pulling the script out, I can't give you an exact example at the moment, but it's just kind of throughout the episode, I feel like some of it's odd. And of course, the Capellans speaking to each other is odd, but that seems to be by design. But yeah, I don't know. It just feels, it feels very 1960s TV, but even more so. Maybe I'll pull out some point. I'll write something. I'll pull some examples out. But anyway, it's just a feeling I get. And then because a lot of it was shot outside, especially on the Blu-ray edition, you can see the difference in the quality of the film. And when it's cut together, it feels quite odd. And they did a lot of dialogue looping as well. And it doesn't always line up particularly well. And it just feels, on the original series, they did a lot of incredible work with very few resources and very little money. And a lot of the times you don't notice it, but this is a case where you kind of feel that they're very strained in their resources when they're putting it together. So that stands out to me a little bit in this episode. And the story itself is not one that I've personally gotten into over the years, but it's really interesting, Larry, to hear your take on it and the reasons that you like it and what they're going for there. And I think that helps me when I go back and watch it again, and hopefully it'll help a lot of the listeners as well. Yeah. So for me, it's sort of a middling episode. I think I'm probably somewhere between Zachary and Char in terms of where it falls for me. But as a rating, I'm going to give it 4 Magnesite Nitron tablets.
Yes.
Very good.
Yes. Nice. Which came
One
back.
One thing I kind of mentioned at some point during the discussion, but then I never really clarified what it was. About the fight and the costume, there's this scene where Akar is fighting, the whole big fight's going on, and you see Akar fighting this guy, and he's got on like the purple carpet and fur, and then they cut really quickly to Kirk running out of the tent, and then they cut back, and it has to be the same guy, but now he's wearing orange instead of purple.
That's why they cut, because those Capellans are damn big and fast, and he's already going down with a different guy on it. That's
already.
I was sitting there watching it tonight, going, "Okay, now is the purple guys and the orange guys two different factions, or like are those?" Because here's the thing that used to bug me.
They
watching
were both fighting Akar, so I don't know.
Well, at one point, I remember like after 3 or 4 waves of rerun watching, because you know the original series for 20 years, it was just like how many times, like they recycled every 3 months if you had a station that kept doing it. So it was like it was kind of like you'd see one go by, and then you knew you had 3 months until you could watch the next go by and catch it. And
there's actually one book that lists this as being aired on, I think it's March 22nd maybe, but it actually aired on December 1st. So like you're saying, like a 3 month cycle.
I'm talking, well, he's talking about original. I saw that too. Through. It's just a typo I think in Steve's. But no, I'm talking about in the rerun years when 79 shows 5 days a week, they're stripping it. So, you know, do the math. That's how often you had to, you know, wait to see your show get before. And yes, kids, in the era before, forget DVDs and Netflix, even VHS tapes, unless you did your own little cassette audio recording off your TV, like some people I understand did. But,
And some people maybe made their own labels as well with the actual logo and everything on it. It's what I hear.
That's. One thing, but before we leave this, one thing. This has a Gerald Fried original score. The dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum, which, you know, was part of the library later on, and the pieces all got used all over the place. But that pounding tribal theme that he wrote for the Capellans at the beginning, and there's so much that got reused later on. That's, you know, Gerald Fried also of Shore Leave and Amok Time. That's another benefit of this show. It was the original use of another great score, great Gerald Fried score. When they had the premiere party for the big original series remastered box set that so many of the music fans were drooling over, they had a premiere event at the Egyptian in L.A. And the big thing of the night was Gerald Fried, who is still up and going. came in with a recorder, oboe type instrument, and had a pianist, and he did a medley of three of his own. And I have it on.
Oh, cool!
I have it on. It's on video on Trek. I taped it. I couldn't believe no more people weren't taping it or videoing it. But there's a video up at because it's Shore Leave and Amok Time and something else.
And that's really cool.
Yeah, he's doing the, you know, the fitting in theme and everything. Anyway, if Trekland, it's up at Trekland if you want to go see
that. I'm looking that up.
But that's something we should mention too, is what a great, great score this episode had, which, you know, everything helps.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Zachary and Shar, thanks for joining us tonight. Before we let you go, let everyone know where they can find you around the network and around the interwebs. So Shar, how about you?
You can find me on To The Journey. New episodes drop on Thursdays. We discuss anything and everything Star Trek Voyager. So if you like that show, give that a look. Otherwise, you can find me on the interwebs. Best place to find me is on Twitter. My handle is OTheProfanity. And I started a little blog about my doings in Los Angeles. Now that I'm in an awesome city, you can go to my blog at OTheProfanity.com and read my ramblings there.
Very good. You're enjoying it there, I take it.
I kind of love it, yeah. It's nice to live in a place that doesn't suck.
Now if we could just get a little rain out here.
Some people, you know, jump in at times and say there are sucky corners, but still.
Well, no, I like L.A. I guess that's a subjective thing, you know.
You love L.A., yes.
That's what I was thinking right now.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks again, Shar. Zachary, where can people find you?
I am very pleased to report that you can now find me as one half of Trek FM's brand new show on Star Trek and philosophy. It's called Meta Treks. If you haven't given it a listen, go ahead and give it a download. We're about to record our third episode, and by the time this hits the network, episode two should be out there. So if you want to listen to me and my esteemed co-host Mike Morrison talk about Star Trek and philosophy, some of the deeper issues in Star Trek and philosophy and theology and psychology and the meta issues in Star Trek, you can find us on Meta Treks. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name. That's Zachary Fruhling, ZachareyFruhling.
To the fruit, to the meta. Oh, wait, I missed
it. To the meta.
Almost to the messed. Meta.
Meta means beyond.
Oh, I guess I guess
in,
oh, boy.
In Greek. So
too,
there you go.
Late. Okay.
Meta Trex.
Doesn't quite work.
It doesn't quite work.
It doesn't
does
have it? The same ring, and I can't channel your voice.
I still like from the meta quadrant, but yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, guys.
It's been fun, guys.
Well, Larry, that was a fun discussion, although I'm not sure if we came around quite as far to Friday's Child as maybe you were hoping we would.
You know what? At this point, my mission in life is not to convert the unwashed to Friday's Child worship. But so measured on that yardstick, I think we did just fine. Shar is just hopelessly lost in the Delta Quadrant and can't get back to simpler, gentler times, I think. But no, that was fun. So. I enjoy getting that. And hopefully out there in the great ether, we turned a head or two.
Yeah, maybe so. All right. Well, you mentioned one thing about writing a paper. And I know that we've talked about that a little bit before. And it's actually for a specific cause, your paper or your essay on Friday's Child. What's that about?
Yeah, I meant to mention it a second ago. But I was contacted about a year ago, a little over a year ago, to take part in a fundraiser for a group called avert.org, which is spreading HIV and AIDS education around the world and information and awareness. And it's outside in, boldly goes. It's 114 unique perspectives on 114 classic Star Trek stories by 114 writers, if you get a pattern forming there. A guy named Robert Smith was the editor. It's coming from ATB Publishing. It'll be out sometime next year as a fundraiser for that organization. And everybody donated a piece to it. And he asked me if I wanted to write about anything from the Kirk era of any incarnation. And I didn't know at first what to do. And then I thought, because I was thinking, okay, so people are going to go for the obvious things. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll just go back to my old meme here about this. I bet there's no competition for that. And no, there wasn't. So anyway.
Everyone's
it's
lining
got
up, Larry, to write about Friday's Child.
Yeah. Not. No, sorry. Sorry to pop your bubble there. Sorry to pop your topoline bubble there, Chris, but no. So anyway, but it was a lot of fun. I got to take a snarkier tone, and I just thought, you know, I'll do it do it with an attitude. And that, like I did way back in the beginning when I did a piece for Mark Altman's Universe magazine, and we did a presentation at the old Grand Slam in Pasadena. That's what I was talking about back in the 90s and years ago. So that was Rob Burnett and I doing these pieces, and we were talking about our top 10 original series. And just to even include Friday's Child in a top 10 from original series, I was this was the 90s also, and I was hooted at and hooted at. And I said, no. And Julie freaking Newmar. And everybody went, oh, okay. But that was a case of waking up one day and realizing once again that maybe the world doesn't always agree with you on everything. So
yeah, this is true.
Stand your ground. So anyway, so I hearkened back to that and thought I'd do this, and it was fun. So sometime that'll be out sometime next year as a fundraiser for that worthwhile group, and I was happy to be part of it.
Yeah, that's cool. I think also you're getting ready to fly over to Houston, aren't you? Is that part of shooting for Con of Wrath?
Yes, I know. It sounds like a stuck record, but we're winding down this yellow brick road of sorts. If not the last, then at least the next to last trip back to Houston to record a few more locals for the Con of Wrath. And I know I've been talking about it for 4 or 5 years. Like I said, I never intended for this to be a regular 6-month production. I mean, I know Adam Nimoy is hard at work right now getting his dad's bio documentary out and done. That's usually how things are done. And the other end of the spectrum is the leisurely thing you do on a micro budget, and you do it a little bit at a time. But we are kind of wrapping it up, and hopefully Con of Wrath will be out, if not in time for the 50th, then later in the year, and for sure by the time of the 35th anniversary of The Wrath of Khan, and 2 weeks later, The Con of Wrath in June of 2017. So right. That we're actually kind of in the end game now, and I'm looking forward to doing that. And then, in the few weeks after that, I'm going to be picking up another survivor out of Atlanta. Later in the year, I'm going to be back east for the Star Trek Continues shoots next, and there's a guy in Atlanta that's going to come down and talk. So I'm excited about that. There's a long-running project that I'd like to finally bring home.
Well, you're staying very, very busy, which leads me to the question of how do you have time to do Portal 47?
I don't. That's my clone. And I'm kidding. Well, the fun thing about Portal 47 was getting it launched, and now that it's launched, it's filling in the gaps and keeping it going. And
so tell people for someone listening for the very first time, what is Portal 47?
Well, Portal 47 was for everybody who's maybe a new fan, but especially people who have been around a while. Maybe you're tired of the same old, same old. I mean, you guys get into all kinds of nooks and crannies here on the podcast. But there's a whole wealth of – basically, it was me looking at my own unique memories from 20-plus years around the franchise and my physical archives, and even more so the people I knew had worked on the show, my Rolodex, I say, of people who you're not going to see at a convention but who have wonderful stories and insights from especially the Next Generation era onward and deserve to be their voices heard. So I've put together a package that kind of emphasizes that. It's basically some of the new tools we have of the 21st century being able to take an all-new kind of deep dive into the 24th. So it's not for everybody, but if you're a background fan or you want to hear more of this, or it's also for people who are maybe isolated and they can't get out to a convention and hear people live. And the podcasts only come out so often. But these are real live voices of people. There's about 10 features to it, and if you want to go over and see portal47.net, it's out there. But I'm going to put up a welcome video fairly soon because I don't want to sound selfish or something here, but it's hard to get the power of this across just as a written list of items. So, and there's some cool things there too. I'm going to have live tours, one day tours if you're in LA, and anytime I'm at a convention around the country where we have members, we'll have a meetup party. Try to get the live event. But this is virtual and online and global. I have people in Europe that are wanting to jump in too. I just have to be afternoon West Coast time for them for an evening. So we have our what I call telebriefings where people are on with a guest and once a month with me. And I bring pieces out of my archives, audio and images, and we share those and use that as kind of a lead off. And of course, the current events of the world, we can talk about that of Trekland, we can talk about too. But yeah, there's several pieces to it, and it's just kind of my answer to what I'd like to contribute to Trek, because books and magazines, and yes, even podcasts seem like they're they can only go so fast. They can only be right. So packed. So yeah. This is a way to get more out, and it's a subscription service, so it's pretty easy to get into. And I've got some more features I'm going to roll out as we go along, but I want to get a good group off. So we sneak peeked it this summer, but you can jump in anytime. And I invite everybody to, if that sounds like something, to jump in. All the recordings we get all the telebriefings we do, we're using a conference call platform, so we're not worried about bandwidth. And people get a recording after it's over too. So
cool. Well, I've been hearing some good things from people who have already participated in it. So hope everyone else will check that out.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for asking. Thank you for asking. It's just going to take a while to be able to talk well about it. Although I enjoy saying, you know, it's like a mini con all year long, coming to wherever your center seat is. But it is. It's like an all new backstage path in a way that you hadn't considered before.
Well, Portal 47, it's a long portal. As you walk down through that portal, things become clearer over time.
There you go. There you go.
All right. Well, people want to get in touch with you elsewhere, you know, social media or websites and all. What are the other places?
Yeah. Well, LarryNemechek.com is always the best hub for Con of Wrath and Portal 47 and our Trekland on speaker CDs. Thank you again for helping me produce those. And all things Trekland, the Trekland trunk, my artifacts that are on sale. Holidays are coming up, so it's a good time to jump in there and look. And we're launching into the 50th anniversary year, and we mentioned it slightly when we were talking about Vasquez Rocks, but Geek Nation Tours, we're having a special double duty tour next year. We're throwing in San Francisco as an option on the tour there with Geek Nation Tours, so that's something else exciting. And yeah, that's Trekland stays busy as always. And thanks for having me on to go back to the roots and talk about Friday's Child tonight. Yeah. Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook and at Larry Nemechek on Twitter.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Always great to have you here. So yeah, if you guys want to, of course, go check out Portal 47, go check out all of Larry's stuff. And then if you want to talk about that with other Trek FM listeners, you can do that in the Babel Conference, and you can talk about Friday's Child or the things we discussed in news there as well. That's on Facebook. Type B-A-B-E-L into the search field and it'll take you right over. It's a closed group, so you need to click join if you're not already a member, and then we'll let you in. But we have wonderful discussions there. We also have our main page on Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm, and our username on Twitter is trekfm. You can also send an email. Go to trek.fm/contact and use the form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that'll come to me by email. Or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm to send us a voicemail. So we would love to hear your feedback on the show in all of those places. Remember that you can get the Ready Room as well as many other shows on the network in iTunes and all the different places that you get your podcasts. And in fact, here's a quick look at some of the other things we've been talking about here on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And they've added something completely new and fun. I don't think anybody would have ever thought, you know, before this, you can't fix perfect. Mm. Well, I don't know, but I'd say that they made it more perfect.
Earl Grey.
Daddy, do pets have a nexus too?
The pexus.
Kirk had a dog in the nexus too, didn't he?
Oh, Butler. Butler is now Shadow. So we have the adventures homeward bound of Butler, Porthos, and Spot. Will they make it back to their owners in Montana?
The orb.
If he had like a game card, his power, you know, like would be higher than any other captain for their persuasion power.
You'll be like, damn, I was winning. And then he went and played a Cisco card on me.
The ready room.
Someone pointed out that this is actually the shortest title of any Star Trek episode. It's shorter than Voyager's Q squared by half a character because the two is superscript.
We're number one. We're number one.
To the journey! It's fake intimacy.
Thank you.
It is them trying to say, Chakotay knows Janeway so well
that just by fiddling her comm badge, he knows the crap's gonna hit the fan.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Here's a quick question. Is the Blu-ray the correct aspect ratio?
The aspect ratio, you've opened up a can of worms. Okay, I'm just telling you right now.
I know that I have, but the thing is, it's because of you that I even cared.
Okay.
The 602 Club.
I think you've hit something here, and I've never thought of it this way, but the true savior of the galaxy, it's not Obi-Wan, it's not Luke Skywalker, it's Aunt Beru.
Literary Treks.
Reagan's a great guy to bring up because his dad was this raging drunk. And, you know, he had to sort of drag him in on off the porch at night because he'd come home, like, falling down drunk. And, you know, you think of, and here he was, this kind of great man for the country at the time. But he came from a place that was really kind of dark and also very relatable.
Women at Warp.
Infinite diversity and infinite combinations, even though it's not necessarily always realized that we're looking at it through the lens of our time. But that ideal is there, and striving to be better and to be more inclusive is such a noble goal.
And introducing Meta Trex.
For Odo, the instincts are so powerful, they sort of override every other factor, every other value, every other choice that he has. And I think that's the point of this view of determinism, that all actions that look like they're freely chosen are really just instinctive behaviors of one, in one variety or another.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows. We have new shows for you every day of the week, sometimes two or even three shows in a day, covering every corner of the Star Trek universe. So I hope you enjoy all the podcasts and all the other great voices we have here on Trek FM. Now, if you would like to find me personally, I'd love to talk to you. You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my username on Facebook and pretty much everywhere. And I'm in the Babel Conference as well, so I'd love to talk to you there. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. I also, from time to time, do our short news show called Hyperchannel, and our show called Continuing Mission, which is about fan films and independent productions. And then if you'd like to read my writing on Star Trek, you can find that over on the official website at StarTrek.com. My latest column up there right now is about fighting time and just how we perceive time. So go check that out if you're interested. One more thing I would like to remind everyone of is the fact that Trek FM is a listener-supported network, and we need your help to keep our shows coming to you every day of the week. It takes a lot of money to produce and host and distribute these shows, and we have many wonderful listeners who support us through Patreon. And that URL is patreon.com/trekfm. You can find out everything that you need to know over there. Every little bit helps. We have a lot of great perks for you. And we also have a new site called Patron Zone. That's at patron.zone. The password changes every month. That's a perk for our listeners. From November 1st, it will be for $5 and up per month. Right now in October, all of our patrons can access that, even on the $1 level. And we have early releases of shows. We have exclusive content there, some exclusive audio content. We also have wallpapers and ringtones and all kinds of cool stuff there. So go check that out. And I'd like to thank all of our patrons who support us, and of course, our associate producers here on the Ready Room, Zachary, who you heard today here on the show, and Renee Roberts over in Germany, who has been supporting the network since the very beginning, and I really, really thank Renee for her support. You can find her on Twitter at @Mares_1701. All right, well, Larry, thanks again for all your time today here on the show. I'm going to wander back down to the camp, because I want to try on some of those Capellan outfits. Those things look pretty cool.
Well, stock up on your carpet cleaner, because you don't want to go off, you know, with a lot of lint. That can be deadly on a desert world like Capella 4. One of the other 10 tribes might, like, hoot at you, and that would be embarrassing.
I live in the desert, so I wear a carpet.
Right. But it has tassels, so it's okay. And my hair is all bound in. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know what? I guess it's about that time, Chris. I'm feeling the same way. I guess it's time to stick a Capellan escalator in it, because the Ready Room is done.
And the child, loving and giving, will go on. He'll go on to rule.
record. Recording.
Recording.
Got a waveform.
Okay.
Pain pants.
Fuzzy pants.
Capellan topoline pants.
Fuzzy Capellan pants.
McCoy pants.
Carpet tassel.
The cool
tassel.
Thing about topoline pants is that you can wear topoline pants on planetoid colonies and you have no problem breathing. You know, you have a built-in life support system.
Okay. Alien carpet tassel pants. Alien carpet tassel pants.
Yeah. I was digging that.